Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we bring you the keynote conversation from Children's Cove Champions for Children Conference held this month in Hyannis. Children's Cove is a nationally accredited child-friendly facility designed, staffed, and equipped to provide comprehensive and coordinated multidisciplinary services to child victims of sexual abuse, severe physical abuse, and witness to violence. Joining me on stage is Sasha Pfeiffer, a reporter for NPR's National Investigative Team and an occasional guest host for some of NPR's national programs. She was a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, where she's best known for her work on its investigative spotlight team, whose stories on the Catholic Church's cover-up of clergy sex abuse won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. That reporting is the subject of the movie Spotlight, which won the 2016 Oscar for Best Picture. Good morning. Thanks for being here. How many have seen Spotlight, the movie? Good number, okay. For those who are not familiar with Spotlight, the movie, or the series that the Globe did, give us a brief description of the Spotlight team's involvement and the investigation into the Catholic Church.
Thank you for this invitation. And because of the work we're going to talk about that I did, which involved a lot of reporting on clergy sex abuse, I think I have an understanding of the kind of work you do and the toll that can take. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking with a lot of victims of clergy sex abuse. And there's a toll that happens even helping people who've been through that. So thank you for the work you do, which I know involves some of the hardest personal and family situations that people do. It's sometimes very unrecognized work, and I know how hard it is. So thank you, and I'm glad to be here today.
All right, so now, give us a little background on the Spotlight team and the investigation, what it is Spotlight does.
So the Spotlight team at the Boston Globe is the oldest continuously operating journalism investigative team at a newspaper. It was founded in 1970. It was based on something called the Insight Team at Sunday Times of London. A Globe editor had gone to that paper, seen this dedicated investigative unit, and decided to create it at the Globe. 2 years after it was created, in 1972, the Spotlight Team won a Pulitzer for a story about rampant corruption in the city of Somerville. In 1989, it was the Spotlight Team that broke the news that Whitey Bulger had been an FBI informant, so that while he was committing crimes, his crimes were basically being covered up by the FBI because he was providing information. So the team has a long history of looking into municipal corruption, crooked developers, organized crime, and in more recent years, we've expanded the kind of stories we do. But it's expensive work, it's time-consuming work, but the Globe has really stayed committed to allowing a select number of reporters to sometimes spend months or more than a year on a single story because they think and they hope the impact will be worth it.
So tell us how this story came to the Spotlight team, the sex abuse in the Catholic Church.
So I think, as all of you know, for many years before we did the series, there had been scattered stories about priests who sexually abused children, Father Porter down in the Fall River Archdiocese. And in the summer of 2001, the Globe got a new editor. His name was Marty Baron. He had come from the Miami Herald. He now is the editor of the Washington Post. Marty's first day on the job, a former Globe columnist named Eileen McNamara had written a column about John Gagan, who was a notorious abusive priest. Over 30 years, he had been shuffled among six parishes and had abused more than 100 children. And John Gagan was actually facing criminal trial, which is very rare. And in Eileen McNamara's column, she noted that the legal files had been sealed by the court. And she wrote something like, because of that, the public will never know the truth. So Marty Baron, on his first day on the job, said, well, why haven't we tried to unseal those files? And it was an embarrassing moment for the Globe because no one had thought of trying to question the sealing of the files. And I think that tells you the benefit of fresh eyes, someone who came in, he's not Catholic, Marty Baron is Jewish, and we think that was relevant because he didn't come in with a kind of deference to the church that was very entrenched in a very Catholic city like Boston. And he asked the Globe's lawyers to take on that case, which they successfully did, but that took several months. So in the meantime, he asked the Spotlight team to learn what we could while that legal case unfolded about how much the church knew about John Gagan, and that ended up unfolding a story that even we wouldn't have ever thought possible.
Now, when Marty said, let's see what we can find out here, it's not like the church is really that forthcoming with, oh, here, come on in, let's talk about this. So talk a little bit about what's involved in trying to get that information.
Right. This was an incredible reporting challenge because the church, it has this privacy right. And what it had argued to get the cases sealed was our right to privacy is greater than the public's right to know what is in these legal files. And Boston was a hugely Catholic city. And if anyone is Catholic and had grew up in the Boston, particularly in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you remember this incredible amount of deference and reverence for the church, which is a good thing, except when it means that you're not holding church leaders accountable and asking difficult questions, even when you sense there's a problem. We were looking at a church that not only did not want to share information, but was legally allowed not to share information. It's not a private company. We couldn't look up financial records. It's not a nonprofit where we could look up 990s or tax returns. So we basically had to start from scratch. There were some small numbers of victim groups out there that we were able to talk to and then try to persuade people to talk. By kind of reverse engineering court records, we were able to find a few lawyers who had really made kind of a bit of a cottage industry in clergy sex abuse victims, settling cases, taking a percentage of the settlement. So it was a slow, methodical process of figuring out what can we find. And we weren't just interested in priests who abused children, but church officials who had covered up for priests who abused children. I think that's the difference between the reporting the Globe did and the reporting that had been done before we got on the story.
All right, so as the story starts to unfold and you start to realize the enormity of what you're reporting here, what were those conversations like with the Spotlight team? I mean, were you all going, is this really happening? I mean, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I think it was like that. I mean, basically the boss told us, the big boss told us to look into the story. When the big boss tells you to do it, you do it. I think we went in thinking, how large a problem can this really be? The church had always argued, this is just an aberration. Father Porter, Father Gagan, this is a rarity. And very quickly, we had seven priests, credibly accused, records, victims. And then suddenly, a few weeks later, there were 20 priests. And I think we thought, this seems like a very large number. By the time we finally published, about 5 or 6 months later, we had confidence saying there had been 71, I think that was our number, credible allegations of abuse against the church. We now know that was a very lowball estimate, but it's what we were comfortable with at that moment, and there was some deadline pressure because records were about to be released that would open the story to other media. But we now know it's hundreds, and we now know nationally it's thousands, and we now know that internationally it's many, many thousands. So this was, sadly, and I think for reasons we're still trying to understand, a systemic problem within the Catholic Church.
Now, you and the rest of the Spotlight team were Catholic, like much of Boston. How did that play into the report? Did it change how you approached this story?
Yeah, all of us were Catholic. I was only slightly different because I have a Catholic mother and a Protestant father. And to keep both sides of my family happy, we actually went to 2 church services every Sunday morning until I went away to college, Catholic Mass, Protestant service. But I think having been Catholic, growing up Catholic, we really understood, again, as I've said, the deference and reverence that people had for the Catholic Church in a city like Boston. You know, if a priest wanted to spend time with your son, take him to camp for the weekend, take him skiing, take him out for ice cream, that was an incredible honor. It never occurred to you what might be happening when that priest took your kid out for ice cream. The priests were also in a unique position to know which families were vulnerable, which families had single moms, which people were struggling, which might be grateful to have a male priest mentor show up. And I think if you're not Catholic and didn't grow up in Boston, you might think, why would you send your kid away? Why would you let a priest tuck your kid in at night? Mm-hmm. I think we understood how your defenses go down and how there wasn't a culture of questioning, even when suspicions began to arise.
And as this reporting starts to unfold, you mentioned, you know, a very Catholic city, and there were people who were, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. And there were people who just didn't want to believe it, right? And what kinds of reaction were you getting? People who were mad at you for uncovering this?
We assumed there were going to be, because the church, the Globe, somewhat ironically, despite what I've described as a culture of deference, there were people that consider the Globe anti-Catholic. And so we thought that when we published our stories, we might have picket lines outside the Globe. And it was interesting because we ended up having the opposite, which was, and I believe this is a case of when you try to use as few anonymous sources as possible. You have on-the-record victims. You have documents that back up your reporting, including, in our case, records from the church's own file cabinets. It becomes irrefutable evidence. And I think that we co-wrote a book called Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. And there was a chapter title called The Decline of Deference. And I think because that respect and deference for the church had been eroding gradually over the decades, it felt like a final straw for people. And instead, there was a real outpouring of upset at the church and a desire to try to change this situation. And we didn't get the kind of upset. I do remember getting a call from a reader who said, does the Spotlight team really feel like it broke some big secret here? She said it was always well known in our parishes which priests you didn't send your kids with. And I remember being shocked by that because, yes, there were certain people in the know, but as I mentioned, because there were priests who, because of their proximity and access to families, knew which families were vulnerable, there was a true grooming and targeting process, I think. I think families and victims were carefully selected, and those families weren't always in the know. Yeah. So in some ways, it was this open secret in certain circles.
Was there an interview that made an impact on you more than another? You talked to a lot of people, and I imagine the hardest ones were the interviews with victims.
Yeah, they really were. And again, I'm sure that so many people in this room can identify with this. I, in particular, and I think it's because I was probably the only woman on the team, I think that men who had been through something they considered very embarrassing and were still trying to work through decades later felt more comfortable telling that to a woman than to a man. And so I talked to a lot of men, 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes older. And if you meet them without any sense of their background, you often see an articulate, intelligent, thoughtful, accomplished person. But they were often stuck in time by something that had happened when they were 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, something intimate and physical that happened at a formative time when they were trying to understand their bodies. And they were truly stuck in place. And it was tragic to me because the harm, the lasting harm of that kind of abuse, which I think everyone in this room understands, is something that you can almost never, ever recover from. And the more you talk about that, it's depressing, but it's also really angering. And I think in our case, that anger felt motivational. Because when you truly feel a sense of a true injustice and wrong, it can make you really determined to want to try to correct that.
Yeah. Those kinds of interviews are tough. They're tough to do. So what do you consider the keys to getting a good interview? And then in some of these cases, I'm sure these people didn't really want their stories shared with the world, but they wanted you to uncover this. So how did you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamentals to a good interview are being a good listener and having empathy but also listening very carefully. So you're trying to determine credibility. You're trying to determine if there are inconsistencies in a story. Having to ask difficult questions about what type of abuse. That was really hard because sometimes they would just say I was molested. And that's really not enough detail. And because how they were molested and what happened could be the difference in what kind of crime someone might be tried with. And so you would have to push to ask difficult, intimate questions, but try to explain sensitively why we need to know this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. There were some people who didn't want to share their story. And we tried to make sure that if we were going to name a priest in a story, we typically had to have more than one victim. And unfortunately, there were so many people calling us that it often was not difficult to find multiple victims for priests, but we really tried to have a very high standard for when we would publish names.
Mm-hmm. Were there any female victims?
There were not a lot, and we had some people critical of the Globe because they said we were ignoring female abuse victims. The reality was probably 90 to 95% of the people that called us were men. I think about 90 to 95% of the cases that would be taken up by the DA were men. And I think that when you think about the church, when were altar girls allowed? 70s, 80s? I mean, for a long time, it was boys who priests had the most access to. It was boys, I think, where parents would be most likely to lower your defenses and think it's fine to send my young son away with a priest for a weekend. You might even hesitate with a young girl. And I think in some ways women were less likely to want to speak up. They were very concerned about what it could do to their family, their marriage. And I think we deal with this today even with adult women. You wonder if people are going to question, well, was it consensual? And I think that's something that women continue to work with, to wrestle with. And for that reason, it made women less likely to want to come forward. We do know that there were often many priests having sexual relationships with adults, and that was almost always women.
What does it look like to try these cases in the press? I mean, as you're mentioning, a lot of this, it's hard to get some of this evidence. And, you know, there was a lot of protection happening there. So talk about trying this in the press.
Right. I believe we had very high standards for that because we were aware of the impact it had to name a priest. We tried to make sure, as I mentioned, there were multiple victims, and usually we looked for some documentation of an accusation and possibly a settlement and a priest being removed from a parish. And then there had been one case, or at least there were one or two cases where priests were later found to have been falsely accused. And we wrote about that as well. I mean, I think we truly tried to write about every aspect of the story, credible accusations, false accusations, you know, because a sad consequence of this series was that Roman collar that priests wear, which used to be such a sign of respect, became a sign of shame. We had priests tell us they felt self-conscious going out in public with that Roman collar. And unfortunately, that's been something that the church continues to have to wrestle with.
Yeah. How did the movie come about?
We did our reporting in 2001, 2002, and probably in 2007 or 2008, so 6 or 7 years later, two young Hollywood producers approached us, and they said they were interested in doing a story about this. And I think all of our first reactions were, can you think of a less appealing story to make a movie of? And who would want to go see a movie about clergy sex abuse? But they kept telling us that what they really want to do is show the reporting process and what good accountability journalism can achieve. And we agreed to do it. And the truth is, I was probably the most skeptical, maybe because I was the one woman on the team. And I do think I actually felt a bit of peer pressure that if all the guys want to do it, maybe we should say yes. And I think what I actually thought is there's no way this movie will ever get made, so there's really no risk in agreeing. The financing hurdles are going to be enormous. Most movies don't get made. The topic is unappealing. And then to my incredible shock, the movie got made. I think it was a wonderful tribute to journalism that showed the best that good accountability reporting can do. In an authentic way, it wasn't a movie that had explosions and people sleeping with sources and meeting with sources in dark alleys. It showed how reporting can be tedious and time-consuming, but pays off. And so it really showed what reporting is. And any of you remember the movie Chariots of Fire? It was sort of this inspirational movie about these bicyclists, as I recall. One of my colleagues at the Globe called it Chariots of Fire for Journalists. And I kind of love that. I think it sums up what it did for an industry that is not doing well financially and really needed the morale boost. Yeah.
So how much involvement did you have then with the movie?
We had a lot. I mean, we spent, the director and screenwriter spent hours and hours and hours with us individually and collectively, basically reporting with us, interviewing us, cross-checking our stories. And then they had us meet the characters that played us and have the actors spend time with us, because a lot of these actors had never played real people before. And I think it felt like a professional challenge for them. Rather than make up a fictional character as you go, they were trying to actually replicate our personalities. And then they invited us to read the script, correct errors, be on set as they were filming. I remember once they had replicated the Globe Spotlight office literally to the paint color. They had the Globe maintenance department look up the shade of paint, and they made it. And I remember thinking, no one except a small group of people at the Globe would have known if it was the different paint color, but they felt like they wanted to be authentic. But on my desk, my fake desk on the set, the phone was in the wrong place, because when you're a reporter, oftentimes you have a phone headset or a phone in your neck and you're typing. And I pointed out that I wouldn't have been able to do that. And they brought in the set crew and changed where the phone was located. So they were really committed to being authentic.
So it was accurate then? The movie was
accurate? I think it was extremely accurate.
Yeah. So is there any part of the investigation that didn't make it into the movie that you wished had, or something that you didn't want that got into the movie?
The movie covers the point at which the investigation begins to the day our first story publishes in January 2002. It didn't cover any of the year and a half to 2 years that came after, where the story just became the sprawling story, no longer just about priests that abuse children, but about why did this happen? Is it because there are no female priests? Is it because the lady has a limited role in the church? It was about Cardinal Law resigning. It was about the church, the Archdiocese of Boston, on the brink of bankruptcy because of the settlements. So the movie only covered 5 months, which it compressed into 2 hours. But I think they knew they had to make it manageable, and so that's how they handled it.
What was the reaction to the movie among some of the survivors that you talked with?
I think we were very concerned about if it would feel very emotional and how they would react. I think they felt validated and vindicated and recognized, and it felt like, I think it felt uplifting to them, which I don't think any of us expected.
You're listening to a conversation with journalist Sasha Pfeiffer. We'll hear more after a break. You're listening to The Point. Today, we bring you the keynote conversation from the Children's Cove Champions for Children conference held in Hyannis earlier this month. With me is journalist Sasha Pfeiffer. Following the Globe reporting and the film, did the report impact your personal or any of your family's faith?
Probably not mine, because I think at that point, I had already felt pretty distant from the Catholic Church. And I do think that after the kind of files that we saw, it would be hard, I think, to feel the same. My mom is a devout Catholic. My grandmother was the kind of Catholic that always had a rosary in her pocket. And I think it didn't really change their faith. And in fact, I remember my grandmother, after the story is published, she said to me once, you know, we just all thought the priests were little gods. And I thought that was so telling, because I think that when you start to think people are gods, that's when you stop asking the tough questions you often have to ask, even of revered institutions. So that reminded me. And for many Catholics, it was crushing. And they had to decide, do I leave the church? Do I reform within, which groups like Voice of the Faithful did? And then some people felt like, I may be upset at the Vatican, but I love my parish priest and I love my parish, and it's not going to change my daily life.
So following all this, did we see more credibility given to Richard Sipe's work? Or?
Richard Sipe was a psychotherapist who, for years, had been this voice in the wilderness saying that there was something like 7% of all priests were sexual abusers of children. And I think people thought that seemed unthinkable. And yeah, it certainly validated his work, and I think gave credit to someone who, he was a former priest, in fact, and it really gave credit to his work.
Did more survivors come forward through SNAP, the Survivors Network of those abused by priests, that that connected with you after this? You mentioned that the phone, your phone started ringing.
The Globe created a tip line where people could call, and it rang nonstop beginning the first day our stories ran. We had to bring in interns to help us take notes. We were flooded with tips, more than we could possibly all write about or handle. But it did, in many cases, because so many allegations were coming in about the same priest that helped confirm. But yes, allegations were pouring in through groups like the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP, DA's offices, other organizations. It was an outpouring.
Yeah. It must have been shocking as you all sitting there thinking about the work you're doing and then to see the amount of people who are coming, knowing that not everybody's coming forward, so that there are more out there.
It was shocking. And to think that some of these people had held this for decades, never told their wives. In fact, I had a guy called me who had gone to BC High, and he said, "I'm ready to tell my story. No one knows, not even my wife, but I want you to tell my story." And sometimes as a reporter, you feel like you have to protect people from themselves. And I said to that person, we are willing to possibly tell your story, but your family has to know this. They can't read that happened in the Globe.
Right. Elaborate a little bit more, if you will, on the trafficking component with Father Paul Shanley. It said in an article that he was pimping one of the victims out. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. So there was a priest named Paul Shanley, who, in my view, was probably the most insidious priest, at least that I dealt with. He was in the 60s and 70s. He had what he called a ministry to alienated youth. And he dealt with homeless kids, kids with drug and alcohol problems, drifters, kids struggling with their sexuality. He did not live in a rectory. He had a private apartment in the Back Bay. He didn't wear a Roman collar. He had long hair and bushy sideburns and jeans and flannel. He was good looking and very charming and really countercultural. He clashed with church officials a lot. And this Paul Shanley created this ministry of alienated youth specifically to make sure he had access to adolescent boys. And he would invite them to his apartment in the Back Bay for counseling. I had people tell me that they would be going through breakups, sometimes same-sex breakups, again, a teenager struggling with being gay in the 60s and 70s when society was not as accepting. And Paul would say, "Well, why don't we? I'll give you access to my body, and that will help you get over your breakup." Or he would say, "Why don't we play strip poker? And that will make you more comfortable with your body if you feel awkward." So pieces of clothing would come off, and you can imagine where that led. And so Paul, one of the victims, told me that Paul would often offer him to other men. And he said, then of course, when you're a teenager and that happens, he said, "I felt like that was my value. My value was sex and my body." That was a terrible case.
Talk about your interview with Father Ronald Paquin and what happened following your investigation.
So Ron Paquin was another priest who was a serial abuser. And we were not able to interview that many priests in person. Most of them avoided us, hung up on us. Ron Paquin, I interviewed in person. And this is a case where the two priests I talked to acknowledged what they had done, but didn't think anything was wrong with it. And one of the things Ron Paquin said was, "I didn't get any pleasure out of it." And I don't know that I still understand that to this day, but his rationalization seemed to be that if I wasn't enjoying it, then how was it wrong? But Ron Paquin did end up going to jail. He served 10 years in a Massachusetts prison. I think just this spring, he was again convicted, this time in the state of Maine, because he used to take kids, I think, on ski trips or camping trips to Maine. That meant he was also eligible for criminal charges up there. And I think he was sentenced to another 16 years. So he's back in prison.
Joe Crowley was one of the survivors that was depicted in the film. Talk a little bit about him and his contribution to the investigation and the impact on his life.
Joe Crowley was one of the Shanley victims I dealt with. And Joe had a really sad story. He'd grown up in Dorchester. He had a mom who was mentally ill. His dad left. He and his sisters were essentially an orphanage for a while. And he ended up being one of the victims of Paul Shanley. He's one of the people that said he became prostituted. And it became this familiar cycle that I'm sure all of you know of drugs and alcohol and depression and a real lack of self-confidence. But he was one of the first people to actually go public. And I think he felt like a pioneer, a vanguard who helped open the door to other people and give them confidence to go forward and not be stigmatized. And I think that empowered Joe until the end of his life. He died on Easter Sunday a few years ago. And I just remember thinking, amazing that it turned around in this way and it ended up giving Joe a sense of purpose at the end.
What do you think this reporting and movie, what do you think the impact has been on the Catholic Church today?
I think we all still see the ripple effects. I mean, that's in a sad way. I mean, just this, about a year ago, it was Pennsylvania that released hundreds of names of credibly accused priests over decades. Again, we're talking, in many cases, not about fresh allegations, but of finally accounting for things that happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And we've seen archdioceses and church and dioceses all over the country finally to try to get names out on the public doing that. We've seen New York extend the statute of limitations so people can still bring criminal charges. We've seen some cardinals, like McCarrick in Washington State, face criminal charges for their own sexual abuse. What I think we haven't seen yet is church officials, like bishops and cardinals, held accountable for what I consider a management failure. You know, I think because a lot of bishops and cardinals, they wear robes and have chalices and there's incense. People forget that that's the manager. That was the CEO. That was the boss. Problems and reports came to them and they did nothing about it. A normal boss would have to be held accountable, but for some reason they were thought of differently. And I think that we're still waiting for that accountability element. And I don't know that it will come, but I hope so.
Yeah. You mentioned the history of the Spotlight team, and certainly this sometimes you sort of can tell what the outcome of your story is going to be, and certainly you couldn't predict how widespread this was when you were doing it. Following that, did it change how the Spotlight team approaches topics? Did the team learn anything from this that they could use going forward?
I think we did. I mentioned that historically Spotlight had looked at crooked developers and organized crime, municipal corruption. And then we realized that another way to find and identify stories is to look at victimized communities. So the project that happened after this one, for example, was about people who had been hounded by debt collectors. And we began to realize if you look at it from that aspect, you can focus more on victims and impact than just the bad guy. And in more recent years, Spotlight has focused on more analytical explanatory stories. You might remember that 2 or 3 years ago, there was some either famous athlete or comedian who had said that Boston was the most racist city in the country. And so the Globe decided, is that true? Is that something you can measure? And objectively, you can't quantify racism, but we decided what can you quantify about how race plays out in the city's schools, housing, sports. And so we looked at that and tried to take a high-level view of where does the city fall short and how can it be better.
What was your, personally, your biggest takeaway from all of this reporting?
I may have referenced this before, and I always feel like it sounds cliched to say it, but this truly taught me the importance of questioning authority. Because no matter what it is, whether it's a high-level government official, whether it's a nonprofit, and you know, I covered nonprofits for a while, and I loved covering this industry, but oftentimes there was this automatic halo that was given to nonprofits, even though they are organizations that can be political organizations run by people. And I think you have to remove that sort of sense of halo and decide you have to still look critically about whether the organization is doing the work well and hold it accountable when it isn't. So as a reminder to me, not to be cowed, no matter how deferential people tend to be to a person or an organization.
Yeah. You mentioned the management problem, and I'm wondering, do you feel like there has been some change in that area since this has come to light, and we've seen it, you know, across the world,
within
not just
the church.
Within the church. Do you feel like that is changing at all?
I think it is changing a little, and we've seen the Vatican attempt all sorts of changes, but it's been 18 years, and they still don't have a firm, non-loophole, worldwide policy for how you report and what you do with accused abusers. And it shouldn't be that hard. And I think some of the things that have changed are that for a long time, mandated reporters, like doctors and teachers, if they suspect abuse of a child, they have to report it. For a long time, church officials and priests were exempt because of the lobbying of the Catholic Church. And after our stories ran, that changed. So church officials are now mandated reporters. Mm-hmm. So I think that means it's probably much less likely that abuse would be happening today of priests by children. Although, as I'm sure everyone in the room knows, oftentimes it's going to take kids a while to tell people what's happening. Mm-hmm. But I think probably the situation is better.
Do you feel there are impactful ways that systemic sexual abuse culture can be tackled in the Catholic Church, such as maybe removing the celibacy statute and allowing priests to be married?
Yeah, I mean, that's very controversial. You know, why it happened is controversial. I mean, people were like, it's because there are too many gay men in the priesthood. It's because priests are celibate. And we tried to take those issues one by one and say, is there any element of truth to that? I mean, I personally believe that for many priests, asking them to live a celibate life ultimately felt untenable to them. I think it's natural for most humans to want to have some kind of intimate relationship. And I think that priests often ended up living a very lonely life that made them And oftentimes, I think priests were really sexually immature because in the 60s and 70s, they used to have pre-seminary, where sometimes when you're 12 or 13, you got already rooted into that environment. And so at a stage when you're developing as an adolescent, it was just this suppression of everything. And I think that created real problems down the line. And we also know that the church has an incredible shortage of priests. So I think that if they can relax some of those standards, I think they can do it in a way that would be successful and help the church with a lot of its staffing problems. Mm.
Do you see similarities or differences between the Catholic Church sex abuse case and other organizations, you know, like the gymnastics abuse, the Jeffrey Epstein case, Boy Scouts, et cetera?
Yeah, there are certainly parallels. And I don't know that I will ever entirely understand why, when there is that intense power balance, oftentimes between adults and kids, we see this happen again and again and again. And why we also see people who are aware that it's happening, but for some reason are fearful for coming forward or they aren't believed. There actually was a podcast created called Believed about the Olympics doctor,
Dr. Nassar, yeah.
Exactly, Larry Nassar. And I remember when that story first came out, I thought, how is it possible that hundreds of gymnasts said this happens sometimes with their parents in the examination room? But then as you got the details of that, and then also once that podcast came out, the reporters were able to get police interviews of a police officer interviewing Larry Nassar. And it was absolutely incredible to hear him. He basically said, they're completely misunderstanding what I was doing. He had this intravaginal adjustment, I think he called it. And then you start to think, oh, I'm starting to understand how this might have happened with a parent in the room, and the doctor found a way to explain it away to a prosecutor. Mm. And I think that it can be hard to understand, but you also see how people who are manipulative can escape detection for a very long time. Mm.
So how would you describe the state of investigative journalism now?
I think there's incredible enthusiasm for it. I often meet young reporters, and the first thing they want to do is become an investigative reporter. And I think the reality is it would be better for them to find a job at a newspaper in terms of whatever newspapers are left, mm-hmm. and get those building blocks of covering municipal meetings and state houses and city halls and police departments. And those are the building blocks, I think, for investigative work. Financially, the journalism industry is in tough shape. The newspaper industry is in devastated shape. I personally consider it a tragedy because I feel like when you have good, solid, responsible reporting, it plays an invaluable role in society of keeping tabs on institutions and organizations. The church story is a perfect example of that. People did not ask questions for many decades, and we saw the aftermath of that, which continues today. So there's enthusiasm for it, and there are a lot of newspapers and media outlets now that are determined to have an investigative team, but it is expensive, and it takes a big commitment of time to have reporters who might be not on the air or in the paper for months, and then you hope that what they spent their time on is worth it.
You're listening to a conversation with journalist Sasha Pfeiffer. We'll hear more after a break. You are listening to The Point. We are bringing you the conversation from the Children's Cove Champions for Children Conference held in Hyannis earlier this month. With me is journalist Sasha Pfeiffer, best known for her work on the Spotlight team from the Boston Globe, whose stories on the Catholic Church's cover-up of the clergy sex abuse won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. You mentioned how when some of the victims came forward, it helped other victims to be able to come forward with their stories. And I'm just wondering, with the Me Too movement, how you see that impacting victims coming forward with their stories now? Because for a lot of women before Me Too, they didn't come forward because who's going to believe me? And this seems to be this kind of change that we're maybe listening a little more and believing people that we would have questioned in the past.
I think that's absolutely true. I also think we're now reaching the point where, I mean, I think everyone in the room knows this. People feel like, are we now getting out of hand? Are we getting to the point where there's belief without asking critical questions, and is it making people vulnerable who have no ability to defend themselves? And I think that the journalism world is still wrestling with how you handle that correctly when this tsunami of accusations come in.
Yeah. Do you feel like readers or listeners have a little bit of news fatigue? And if so, how do you overcome that?
I think people have more than a little bit of news fatigue. I mean, I think that people feel overwhelmed by news because of the rate at which it now comes at us. I think they often feel overwhelmed by bad news. And I think people have what I consider outrage fatigue. I think especially because of the negative aspects of social media, where people are just screaming and yelling all the time about everything with very little nuance, and often before they understand the full story. It makes people want to decide, I just can't anymore. I have to stop reading and stop listening. And I think that's too bad, because we need to figure out how do you make sure you're still informed and stand back from all the screaming and yelling and make sure you understand the story and form your own judgment. And that's a real challenge for reporters. The most recent story I did for NPR was about Guantanamo, which many people think was shut down by President Obama, but which is alive and well. You know, Guantanamo in Cuba still has 40 detainees, 26 of whom have never been charged with anything but have been held down there. And it's cost $6 billion since 2002. They spend at a rate of about $500 million a year. There's 1,800 guards, which are Army Reservists or National Guard units that get activated to go and guard those 40 people. And it's just this, and it's just by even most objective measures, it is a massive amount of money spent. And yet the court process is absolutely stuck in place. There's a trial date, but most people, for the 9/11 defendants who to this day have not been tried, most people think that's a fantasy trial date. I care a lot about the story. I think it's really important. I think my story had nice impact, but then it gets swept up in the river of other news. And so I think that for all reporters, you're trying to make sure people care. And also, because the politics today takes up so much of the oxygen of public attention in the media, I think other important issues get neglected. So that's, I think, a struggle for all reporters.
Do you want to talk about just the news business for a minute? I was last week at a news meeting in Boston, and we were talking about some slides about the state of news, and I think it was from 2007 to 2015 or something, newsrooms declined 45%. With the exception of public radio newsrooms, which we both work for, which have been increasing. So luckily we're seeing an increase there. But they had this slide that just really blew me away. It had the United States and what they called news deserts, right? 171 counties in the country have no newspaper at all. I'm forgetting, it was a couple of thousand at least, that only have a weekly. And we're seeing this decline in especially local news. And yeah. I'm just wondering your thoughts with this. It's sort of a disturbing trend. I mean, we're lucky enough to be working for an organization that is growing, is still growing, but that's not the case for many newspapers and the local radio stations and the commercial.
Yeah, I think this is it's a total tragedy. I really do. I mean, and what's left is often so tiny, and young reporters who want to learn but have no experienced reporters to learn from. And it's just... Yeah, I just think, and we're not even talking about national news. I mean, the New York Times, the Washington Post are doing fine. But who is going to cover? Who's going to go to the school committee meetings? Who's going to go to the city council meetings? Who's going to cover the state houses? That's not going to happen. And we'll never know what doesn't get reported.
Yeah. What about on the national level? Is there an issue or a system out there that people are not paying enough close attention to that we should be?
I mean, I think, you know, to me, my Guantanamo stories were a perfect example of that. I mean, I think that it's just because Guantanamo was put very far away in a remote area that's very difficult to get to and that most of the public doesn't have access to. You know, I tend to try to think at a very idealistic level about taxes, right? When that third or so of my paycheck goes away every week, I think that's for our roads and that's for our schools and that's for our libraries and that's worthwhile money. But when you go to a place like Guantanamo and you see these hundreds of generators trying to keep these buildings from being filled with mold and the Caribbean heat and broken down buildings, you just think, This is where my taxes are going, right? And so I think that issues like that, especially when they're deliberately put in faraway places in hopes that people won't pay attention, get lost, and I wish people would care more. But I also understand that there are a lot of things to be concerned about, and so people's attention gets competed for.
Yeah. I'm sure some of you have questions. We have a couple of microphones, right, that for people who have questions out there. You want to raise your hand if you have a question? Right over here.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for being here today, Sasha. My question is about these types of reports of systemic abuse and cover-up. Sometimes they seem almost conspiracy theory. How do we get the everyday American to move towards a place of believing and understanding that the stuff is actually happening?
I mean, I think that I think a lot of people do believe it's happening, right? But I think we also have to rely on good, solid reporting and people being critical about what they read. I mean, I wish people... This is a fruitless wish, but I wish people would read more and different types of outlet, listen to more and read different types, you know, left-leaning, right-leaning. Yet people, I think, are reading less. And so I just think it, I think today it requires a much more informed and as a news consumer, I think there's more responsibility for all of us to try to make sure, is what we're reading accurate? Do we feel good about this reporting and this media outlet? And I don't think most people are going to take the time to do that, but I think that's what it would require.
Yeah. Another question? Right over here, who has the microphone?
That's okay.
Oh, he's bringing you the microphone, right? Right behind you. Yeah.
There's a scene that I remember from Spotlight, the movie, where one of your colleagues finds out that one of the houses where the church was stashing the priest is around the corner from his own house. Can you talk a little bit more about the real life scenario there and sort of the thought process and the internal workings?
Yeah, that was my colleague Matt Carroll, and he lived in West Roxbury. And that and the priest, he realized as he was doing this research, he thought he found the address, and he thought, I think I know where that is. And there's a scene where he goes and stares at the house. And Matt had four children. One of the things that we saw and reported on was that even when the church began to try to do the right thing by defrocking priests who had been credibly accused, they often just let them loose. They just expelled them. And so we found that priests were living on their own, unsupervised, all over the place. In fact, when we did locate priests, for some reason, many of them we found on the Cape. I think probably because at the time it was an affordable place for them to live. And so, but also we found many priests down in South and Central America. A lot of, you know, many, many very Catholic countries that still have a lot of deference for the church and where that abuse could continue. And we the Associated Press recently did a story.
I was just going to say that, yeah, like 1,700 that they uncovered.
The AP, because of this wave of archdioceses and dioceses now releasing names of priests accused over the decade, there's about 5,000, I think, new names that have come out recently. The AP was able to find 2,000, located them. 1,700 of those priests were basically unsupervised, sometimes working with children. And, you know, it, really a lot of these priests should have been on sex offender registries. And so, again, I think it's an example of the church taking a step towards doing the right thing, but not totally doing the right thing. And so there are a lot of people out there unaccounted for.
It sounds like we need some changes to the sex offender registry, right?
Probably.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Have you continued to connect and follow up with the survivors?
I have. In fact, Joe Crowley, who I mentioned, who was one of the Shanley victims, was he kept in touch with me for years and years and years. I like to go to a lot of plays, and Joe did too. And so sometimes I'd be at the Huntington Theater or the New Repertory Theater, and I would see Joe in the lobby, and he would send me text message or emails about his little critiques of the play. And, you know, as a reporter, you're often trying to figure out what is the appropriate relationship to have with people you're covering, because you might like them, but you really want to be careful about thinking about them as your friend, because you may have to report something unflattering about them eventually. But my feeling was, it felt pretty harmless to me to, you know, write back and forth to Joe once in a while about play reviews. And I think it was helpful to Joe. I think it was someone who had heard his story, and he didn't end up feeling used, like we interviewed him, wrote a story, and moved on. And Joe, Joe must have died 3 or 4 years ago. He wrote and emailed to me for 15 years after that. And it was really wonderful. I mean, it was wonderful for me because I also got to watch him recover. And so, yeah, some of those relationships ended up being surprisingly satisfying given the way we met.
I would say sometimes, too, that must be difficult because you've been interviewing these victims who are sharing these very personal stories, and there's part of you that probably wants to go, you know, are you okay? I mean, after this is all said and done, you want to check in with them, but, where is that line? And how do you, so were there others that you kept in touch with as well?
Yeah, there were many. But, yeah, I can remember that where, you know, oftentimes the people were telling us the most intimate, and as I mentioned, in many cases, they were just so embarrassed by what had happened. They were still trying to understand it. They felt so foolish. And you spend all this time on the phone with them, asking them these incredibly intense and personal questions. And then I was always aware, I hang up, and they're just left to sit with that. And I would usually try to say to them, you know, this might be tough after we talk. Make sure you have someone you can talk to. I always felt like I was willing to take calls as long as they wanted to talk. But yeah, I feel like you have to remember what we're triggering and what we're unearthing and be sensitive to that.
Was it frustrating to not be able to get the answer from Bernard Law? Like, how could you? And, how much did you really know? We talk about that kind of management problem, and they're not, when you're thinking about these numbers and what they had to know and what they covered up, Was it frustrating to not be able to have them give you a heart-to-heart as to why?
Yeah, a little bit, but also in a way not surprising. There was just there was an arrogance. I mean, the church was used to not answering questions, and I think it felt like it didn't want to. When we started doing the story, the Boston Archdiocese had a public relations spokeswoman who was new to the job, had never done crisis PR. I think she thought she had been in the TV business, and she thought she was going to take a quieter, more civilized job, 9 to 5. And then the largest public relations catastrophe ever to strike the Catholic Church happens. And she just was she was so over her head. And the church wasn't telling her anything. I remember at one point we had asked where Cardinal Law was, and she said he's in the office, and then someone said, no, he's actually in Rome. And I don't think she actually knew he was in Rome. But I remember that when we finally were ready to go to the church and say, we have questions, that she actually said that not only were they not going to answer our questions, but they didn't want to know our questions. And to me, that was also public relations 101 blunder. At least take our questions, because then you would know what we want to ask. You'd get some intel. But they were just really over their head. Yeah. The church, it was frustrating. And Cardinal Law, he did resign, but he then basically got a promotion at the Vatican.
Right.
So it was telling of how the church handled that.
Right over here, Jake.
Tying back to the statement about news fatigue and just how much is out there, do you feel that if the story broke today, the issue being unearthed today, that it would gain the same amount of traction that it did 18 years ago?
I wonder that all the time. And I wondered that again after my Guantanamo stories came out. And I was hoping that it would create such outrage that people would say it's finally time to decide. If you have to try them, or you have to charge them, or you have to send them to a supermax prison, you can't leave these guys down there uncharged with $6 billion and counting. But it didn't have that impact. And so I wonder, could even the story that we did in 2002, would it have mattered as much today? I don't know. I mean, people are deluged by news. And I think the news often feels so terrible that it dulls us to really terrible things. So I do wonder. I think that we also, by the way, when that story ran, it was the early era of the internet, which seems impossible to believe, but it was the ability finally for stories to go online, so you didn't just have to get the Globe on your doorstep to know about that. So it was able to spread, but now everything spreads. Mm-hmm. And so it also came at a unique moment in time for us. So I don't know that it would have the same impact.
Right. Yeah, and now with our social media, and it's like, how many times you go on Facebook and you see something that somebody has posted as a legitimate story and you're going, no. But
right.
It happens all the time.
Right, and that's where I think having to be a really informed and critical news consumer is so important. And I'm afraid enough people don't do that.
Right. Anybody else? No, right over here.
Do you feel like there is some way to hold people accountable for reporting accurate information instead of spreading inaccuracies?
I think media organizations have to make sure they're hiring really good people and then fire or sanction the ones that don't. I think that for me, I'd rather get something correct and in detail than be the first one to report it. But if many people are intent on being that first one to get that scoop or break that news on their Twitter account. And I think it has to be a culture of a newsroom, especially in this day and age, where the media is under so much scrutiny and so much attack that you cannot afford to make mistakes. I just think mistakes are unacceptable. I mean, you have to vet where information is coming from and hold accountable people when it's wrong. There's no room for error if the media wants to be believed and relied on and trusted.
Okay. Sasha, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Children's Cove provides a compassionate, efficient, child-friendly facility for child abuse intervention. You can find more information about their services at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.